Hello, I am Rose Reeson, and there are two things you probably need to know about me for this talk to make sense. So the first thing is I am a user researcher, so I research how people use technology in order to make it intuitive to use. Are there any user researchers in the room? I'm the only one. Fine. Okay, cool. And I just sort of want to pause on the intuitive bit of that. So intuitive can mean removing barriers so that people can consume an online service, and this traditionally has been what user research is all about. But when I say intuitive, I also mean about understanding and applying technologies for your benefit, so that people can understand where the information comes from, for example, and then use that information to do something that makes our lives a bit easier. So fundamentally, when I say I'm a user researcher, what I am talking about is trying to empower users or empower people when they're using different technologies, not just online. Can I do a quick hands up? Has anyone done user research with this bit? This is a very unfortunate picture of me, but it's the only picture that I have of myself. When I started a meetup about 2 years ago called People Before Pixels in a very different venue to this. As you can see, it's a tiny room above the pub. It was really hot that day. There's a taxidermy crocodile just behind where the picture's being taken. So it's a bit punky. And I just want to pause here and go, if there's anyone in the room who's thinking about starting a meetup or get together, just do it. I did a lot of prepping before I managed to get into this tiny pub. So just let people know on the internet where you are and what time today, and make it happen. And I was terrified, to be honest, when I started it. It was supposed to start at 6 o'clock, and I had only one person in the room who I worked with at that point. They were very good at supplying me crisps and wine. It's about an hour later when there was a little flood of about 7 or 8 people who filled that room. You can see them there. And it was really impressive because they'd braved the London rush hour to come and talk about one thing, really, which was how do we actually put people first when we're designing public sector services. And that's pretty incredible to persuade people to do that. I saw a few hands up with people saying that they've done some research before, so I'm sure you've all sort of thought about how you put people first in your digital services. But today, I just want to explain and share my experience of putting people first over the last 2 years and some of the things that I've noticed in the public sector, both the good and the bad. And then I'll finish off with some tips or questions, really, for you guys to go and have conversations about in rooms of pubs and stuff. And just to give you a bit more of an idea of where this talk is going, the alternative title for it was The Only Way is Ethics. So just prepare for it. So 2 years ago, this was the mission. And it was a pretty simple mission, really. It was just persuading people with money that getting the team, building the service, talking to the people using the service wasn't a total waste of time. These are stickers from GDS, which is the government digital service, and they were really useful in getting this message across. Not only did they have spend controls, but they also had lots of catchy posters that started going a bit viral, and people walk into a random government department and you see GDS posters there. And there would be things like start with needs and understand context and trust users delivery, I think it was an official strategy. Find what works, not what's popular. Still having to say that quite a lot these days. 2 hours every 6 weeks, so that's 2 hours of user research every 6 weeks of development. And user research is a team sport, that's some of my favourites. There was also a rumour going around at the time that the chief technology officer had a phone case that said, what is the user need, that he would flash up in meetings if he thought that they were going off track. And this was all really useful, and it was also really exciting, and it felt like we're in the midst of a revolution where finally the people, the small people using the service were having a say in how it was made and how useful it was. But if I'm honest, I'm still having to do quite a lot of this today, so the mission is not over, we're still getting the word out. So as 2 years ago, as digital teams across the public and the private sector were sort of grabbing hold of this idea of putting people first, it became quite apparent that the teams were applying that in slightly different ways for different effects. And one of these examples, and I won't name and shame, is there's a digital team from government who were really excited about doing ethnographic research, diary studies in this case, with real people. And if you've tried to recruit for user research, you know, probably know how hard it is to find real people. And so they decided that they didn't need to tell these people that they were from government. And so they did a couple of months' worth of diary studies with them, these people, you know, writing a diary every day. And then they went away and they analysed it and they applied it to their service. And eventually they did tell them, oh, hey, we're from government. And all of the participants were happy, suspiciously, to continue with the ethnographic research, which is great. But it made me, as a user researcher, feel really uncomfortable. Oh, and I just realised that I didn't tell you the second thing you just meant about me. So I've just gone a quick tangent. So the second thing is that I did an anthropology degree, and anthropology as a discipline has its roots in basically systematic racism. So anthropologists in the Victorian time were going around measuring people's skulls, applying census in India, which had a big effect on the wealth of people at that time. And as a result, anthropologists now are painfully aware of systematic violence that might result of their research. And so I've always got this little voice at the back of my head going, are we creating a structure that might sort of apply some violence in some sort of soft, intangible way? And so when I heard that this team had gone off and done some diary studies, ethnographic research, and not said that they were from government, I immediately went, wow, that's quite a big part of the government to have to go and do some research and not say who they are, where they're from. If I was that participant, how would I hold that person to account? How do I give informed consent? How do I retract my personal life that I've already shared with government at that point? And I think the anthropology background really brought that to the front of my mind. And it also started making me think about slightly different questions. So how is user research changing the way that people have a relationship with government and how they use those services? Are the users really being empowered here, or are we empowering government in a new way? And to answer some of these questions, I thought I would do some research on my own community, People Before Pixels. So we've got slightly better at finding rooms. So this is the event hall in Newsby House, which is saved my skin several times. And we started having lots of really interesting discussions and lots of topics. Some of my favourites are how personas might be encouraging stereotyping in digital teams. Personas are sort of not real people who maybe represent a group of needs with a particular context. There was another really big one, which is how edge cases. So, the minority users of your service might be meaning that we work for less diversity, not more diversity. There's things around the relationship between the user and the decision maker, so if I apply for a driving license, how do I know he makes that decision about me at the point that I apply for that license, and how do I disagree with them? And as we're having all these really interesting discussions, I started paying attention to the language that people were using and what they meant when they were using those words, and the kinds of methods that they were advocating in these discussions. And this is what I discovered. So to describe the people using services, people tend to talk about humans, users, or really the user experience, and citizens, which is a really interesting way of describing people. And these sort of broadly reflect three main methodologies: human-centered design, user experience design, and design for systems. And I thought this was really interesting, and I wanted to see if how aligned they were and how unaligned they were, and if there were any biases creeping in the way that they were thinking about people. And I just want to stop quickly and say, I think human-centered design, user experience, and design systems are all really useful and they all are really good. And if you're not doing any of these things right now, then just Google one of them and start doing that, and you'll be in a good place. But I just wanted to see if there are any biases. So speaking of Google, I thought I'd use the lens of Google to see the types of things that I would get as a result. So I'm starting off with humans. So I did a Google image search for human. And this is what came up. So we have a nice silhouette of someone standing. We've got lots of naked white people when you Google human. These are also quite hairless naked white people. We have anatomy, particularly muscle anatomy, seems to be very human. We've got some pictures of evolution. We've got very cute babies. And then in the bottom corner, which I don't think you can see very well, there's a white man in a suit. You've got to watch out for this guy because he comes up a lot. You'll see him again. And I thought this was really interesting because basically through the lens of Google, we think human is a sort of an evolving part of flesh. It's sort of what I got from that. So I thought I'll be really diligent and I'll just see how much this changes when I do a Google image search for human-centered design. And this is what I got. It's quite different. It's a little bit less fleshy, but we've definitely got we've got brain forming onto someone's hands, I think. And we've got some simple Venn diagrams, and we've got some sort of process flows, and they're quite pretty as well. I thought, there's a bit of a shift there. But I noticed that these four things were the things that were coming up quite a lot when people were talking about humans in those discussions. So they're looking at the sort of physical aspects of being human, so you're a fleshy person with a sort of bit of metal that you're using to access the internet. The ability to perceive things came up quite a lot. Are they understanding your writing in the way that you want them to understand? The ability to process what they've perceived, so cognitive ability came up, lots of psychology, how can we sort of nudge people into doing different behaviour by showing pictures and things like that. And also the emotional state and how the emotional state impacts your interaction with this sort of cold hard machine in front of you. And my sort of summary is that people who are talking about humans were really talking about the mind and what's in the mind and how the mind affects your ability to interact with software. And so that's interesting, so you think that's what I'm going to do next. And so the next thing I did before was user. And this is what came up for user. So we've got the blue blobby people, who I actually think look like game pieces, you know, Cluedo. We've got white hipster avatars, there's quite a lot of those. And there's a thing in user research where we keep asking people not to design for themselves, they are not the user. And I think the fact that there are white hipster avatars might be telling us something that's happening more broadly in this room. And then look, we've got the white man in the suit. Harvesting the users who are all sort of zooming into his online service. And at the bottom, there are sort of pictures of users that they sort of ring fenced with this sort of red marker pen. So I thought that's quite different from what we saw with the human. And this is what I got for user experience. I've been really diligent. We've got really complicated but still quite pretty Venn diagrams. We've got designers and developers building the user experience out of various widgets. So the UX has got lots of widgets in it, and these are designers inserting widgets onto the screen. We've got the desire line, as I recently learned that it's called. And there's hundreds of photos like this where there's a path, and everyone's ignoring the path to get a shortcut across the graphs. And then at the bottom, which you can't really see, there's a silhouette of someone's head, probably a man's head, haircut, at least the and then we've got cogs inside his head, and lots of widgets coming up this cog, this machine element, and it looks like he's accessing a shared folder at the moment that this diagram's been drawn. But that's also quite interesting, so if you think back to, in fact, you don't have to think back, so I can take you there. If you compare it to this, it's quite different. It's definitely a lot more complicated, and it's also a lot more sort of machine. Did that make you all to see? And so these are the four main things that I noticed that people were talking about when they were talking about users and user experience. So there's the usability, can someone interact with this machine? There's the accessibility, are there any barriers to them interacting with that machine? And how do you remove those barriers? There's the transactional relationship that Matt is harnessing up other men in businesses. And it's also very individual, even if there are lots of individual actions. And there's a real shift here from thinking about the mind and how the mind interacts with the machine to looking at behavior and activity. And it's all about defining your user by their activity and whether that activity results in a sort of completed stage or not. And it's a single user through time. Are there any questions at this point? No? Okay. So this is the last set of Google image search results, I promise. So I googled the citizen, which is the other frequently referred to term for people, and I found lots of flags, and very specifically American flags, but also some British flags. And so in the far right corner we've got, I think it must be some sort of sports game with people waving the British flag, and the bottom is the American flag, same thing, big crowd of people waving the flag. We've got people swearing their allegiance to the American flag there. We have protesters waving the Palestine flag. We've got politicians meeting community groups. And then we've got these silhouettes of people holding hands across the world. And I thought, oh, that's interesting because we haven't seen people together before. We've seen them as sort of individuals. So there's a bit of a shift happening now. And so I did the same for design systems. And actually, I was a bit disappointed. Not much came up. Lots about a watch. I think there's a watch called Citizen, which would be helpful. But I took the watch out, and this is what I found. I don't know if you can see that well. So there's a picture of a cafe with some sort of schlumping silhouettes in front of it. It looks like quite an upmarket cafe. There's underneath the bridge, someone's laid out a bunch of pink mats. And then at the bottom, we've got like a little booklet, which shows you the New York skyline, I think it's called. And then there's a map about water at the bottom. And I thought, well, this is a bit pathetic in terms of sort of designing the systems in a digital sense, because there's no digital stuff here. This is all about architecture and public space. And so I think some of the design and system ideas might be being pinched from architecture, which is interesting in itself. But I also noticed how well-heeled it seemed and the absence of flags. So bear in mind, when I searched the system, all I found was flags in the eyes of Google. And now, all I can find is sort of slightly hipster, slightly cheesy sort of spaces. And so I thought, actually, so comparing that with all of the meetups, the things that we were talking about were sort of like a sense of place, the state, so how do you hold your state to account, and specifically your relationship with the state, so what can you do legally, rights, the fact that everyone has equal rights, and a sense of collective, so it's very hard to be an individual citizen in a private world with some other people, which is very different if you think back to the user, the transactional individual, and the fleshy human being perceiving and just processing content. So let's put all of these together. So we've got the first line is your humans, second line is your users, and the third line is citizens. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. So these are all the kinds of things that we've been talking about, these people that we're going to put first in our digital services. What's missing from all of this? Are we putting all people first? Are we putting everyone first? And I thought, actually, the stuff we know the least about is the bottom line, about citizens. And we've not really thought about other groups of people, like children, for example, or people who don't have citizenship. And that's kind of interesting in itself. There's someone earlier mentioned, I think Rachel mentioned caring. So like if you're being cared for, how do you access the internet? How do you represent yourself and the internet with the help of someone else? Okay, so I've had a think about it, and I thought there were four sort of key areas that you guys could kind of talk and talk about, maybe apply in your everyday lives. So this is the first one. So where has this come from? It's just a picture of the water cycle. So where has this information come from? Might be a good way to think about this. And where is my information going? And the example I like to think about this is certificates. So if you had an official piece of information from government, that government could stamp that and go, like, this is from government. So that when it got reused across the internet, that if I was reading the Daily Mail, I could see that this statistic came from government and be able to trace it back. But also, if I still contribute information, so the Google app is really good at sort of knowing when I'm in a cafe that hasn't got all the information out on the internet, so it'll pop up on my phone and it'll be like, hey, does this cafe have accessible toilet, or, you know, is this cafe open at night? Those kinds of questions. And I got quite addicted to it, and then I sort of stopped and I went, but wait, actually, where is this going? Like, is this only available for Google, or can anyone access this? And so that's really important with information as well. And if you think if someone wants to replicate the Google app pattern, how people who were perhaps more trusting but less confident wouldn't know where their information is going, so they might get asked quite personal questions that suddenly go into things like that. This is now again harvesting users, obviously private or personal data. So yeah, I thought where has this come from is quite interesting. And where is it going? And there are some good examples. So, you know, Wikipedia is a really good example of people contributing information and knowing where it's going and how it's edited and sort of that kind of access. But I think this could go further than Wikipedia. You could design this into any sort of online transactional service so that everywhere people would know how to sort of take down their information or give better information. Does that make sense? Another way, other than certification, to think about this is a single shared view. So this is perhaps very specific to a public sector setting, but there are services where I'm working on, and the agent has a profile, and the user has a profile as well. And the idea is that they see exactly the same thing, so that they have the same conversation, rather than having two interfaces, one for the end user and one for the agent. And that's another way about having a conversation about where is this information going and who can see what, knowing that you've got a single shared view of the information about yourself with a particular service. So the next one is knowing what rights exist. And this is really about the extent of your rights. So it's very hard to apply or say that you have the right for something if you can't see the parameters of those rights. It's a bit like if you were trying to find out the answer to a question but you didn't know what information existed, how would you go about getting an answer to that question? So knowing the sort of scope of your rights broadly at the point that you're interacting with an online service would be really useful in giving people accountability to ensure that those rights are practiced. Being yourself online is another useful conversation that I think we need to have. So this is the mother, sister, daughter chatting craze sort of happening at the moment. So presumably a mother, sister, daughter have all got the same tattoo of a Russian doll. And this is the idea that you are yourself as an individual, but you are also yourself as a mother, you are also yourself as a sister, and you are also yourself as a daughter. And how could you be that self online? So a really good example of this is second generation immigrants. And so the children might be in school, and their English is probably pretty good because they're in school every day, but their parents' English might not be so great. And so when their parent is paying their rent online, for example, it might actually actually be the child that's going through that service for them? And how do you represent that when you're thinking about the people that you're designing for online, that you can have a household accessing a digital service, not just an individual? And how do you build that so that it's easy for children to use, but also to say, hey, I'm not actually, if I do this wrong, don't assume that I've done it wrong maliciously. Assume that, you know, a 6-year-old or 7-year-old has been filling out the online form on my behalf. So that's the sort of tangible example that I like to think this about. There are lots of cases where there are dependencies or groups of people who need to go online. So you can think of small organisations that are self-organising, so they haven't got an appointed secretary or an appointed social media person. It's just sort of ad hoc on who does what when. So that's another good thing that I think, another good pattern that relates to sort of being yourself online. And then finally, that I beg to differ button. So I actually pinched this from a comic book called Book of Pages. It's a really good comic book, you should definitely read it. And it's about saying, no, technology has got this wrong about me. I beg to differ. I would like to apply my own context to the situation. I would like to disagree. And providing that as a systematic pattern that happens in your design. So that you can disagree with the technology. And I think the SatNav is a really nice example of this. So everyone, I'm sure, has seen a don't follow your SatNav sign on the road somewhere, particularly if you've been going down country lanes. But there are these big problems with big sort of SUVs getting stuck on driveways and things. So they were following their SatNav. The information on the SatNav wasn't quite right for the HGV, and this is about allowing that HGV driver to go, hang on, I think I'm a bit big for this road, and to disagree with their SatNav. And I think once you enable the beg to differ button, you also enable all the other things that I've just gone through. So you enable the understanding how the technology works, where the information is coming from, and how you can contribute and apply it. You enable the sort of knowing your rights and knowing that you have the right to override that bit of technology, and also having a right to represent people online or be an organisation online. So I think once you do all the other things, this will be really easy. Or once you do all this thing, it will make you think about all the other things that I've just talked about. And that is the end.